Hi, welcome back to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Brock Hammond, and joined with me is my co-host, Garrett Boyum. Garrett, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing, Brock?
Good. Working, playing, living, learning. What about yourself?
Similarly, going to school. We just started, we're actually in our second week of the off season with the guys at Missouri State. Been writing throwing programs, a little bit of conditioning. Just spending a lot of time programming, looking at volume, trying to manage workload, do some mobility stuff, making sure guys are getting taken care of.
So talk to me a little bit just about how things are different now that you're moving out of fall ball into like a post fall ball environment with your guys. How are you changing kind of the coaching? What is different as far as like how you're interacting with the guys? So just take me kind of the difference between the environments you're putting players in like during fall ball versus outside of fall ball going into the winter.
Right now, how things are going is everything's kind of slowed down a little bit. We're collecting more data in terms of we're starting to implement blast with our guys. We just introduced weighted bats today. On the pitching side, a lot of guys are shut down, although a few guys are throwing as well, which I think is good that they continue to throw maybe at a lower intensity. But from the standpoint of development, there needs to be a good on-ramp. Our guys aren't trying to really develop velocity, so we can take some time off and then actually have another on-ramp to build them back up. But I think something that's really important is to make sure that there is an on-ramp to give guys a good base. So right now, it's a little. What's different from the fall is that it was more focused on playing games, and there was a little bit, and also introducing guys to certain concepts. Now it's about more implementing those concepts in a developmental sense and then building off of those. So that's kind of what the transition's been more like.
So it sounds kind of like, in a way, kind of like a deload period, so to speak, kind of on the volume side, like on the first part of winter, and then just doing a lot of data collection with probably a lower focus on like actual, I guess, changes. Are you just kind of leaving them alone, or is it more about are you kind of going, Are you like using both like simultaneously, like collecting data and like allowing that to shape some different coaching mythology?
It's kind of hard for me to say, one, because I'm not the hitting coach. So I think we're kind of doing a little bit of both. We're collecting data, and then we're also using that to inform how we're kind of working with them or coaching with them. So, I mean, it's kind of, I guess, just a learning process. The big thing that I think we're doing different this year is thinking a little bit more about load management. As we're going through this process, 'cause the big thing there is that if we're able to have at least an understanding and appreciation of the load, we can reduce injuries. And then if injuries do occur, we at least have an idea of what the load was, you know, and we can look at it from the standpoint of, was the load too high or was it too low? Because sometimes guys get injured because the load was too low for an extended period of time, and then all of a sudden they ended up doing more than they were used to doing, or just maybe again, the load just was too low. So if you don't track it, you can't, you know, measure it and make adjustments. You're just going to have to rely on memory, which we know sometimes is not that reliable.
Mm-hmm. I saw one of the guys that I really like and respect their work on Twitter. His name's David Howell. He mm-hmm. was an intern at Driveline. Now he works at LSUS.
Mm-hmm.
And he had created, I think it was maybe like a Shiny app through R, mm-hmm. where based on the hitter's like blast metrics, they were automatically getting placed into like drill groups where they would focus on different drills that are prescribed to improving different, you know, swing flaws or characteristics that those hitters had. So, mm-hmm. you know, for one, one group had like hitters that had too low of attack angles, so they kind of have like a flat vertical approach. And so their drill work was focused on increasing their attack angle. So I think the drill like that he had prescribed out was like very loopy, like plyo ball tosses. So mm-hmm. you have to really like overemphasize the attack angle, which is good. And they had another group for, it was like built for bat speed. So it was more focused on like weighted bats with like an emphasis of just like, you know, raw like power creation. So that's, I mean, that's something that I've seen kind of in the winter period of college players that I really like how he had like designed that, and just a good use of technology to kind of help shape, you know, the environments that he's putting the hitters in, which is kind of a nice segue, I think, from the last podcast we did.
Yeah, and even to go on that note, those would be what you're mentioning more of, changing the task constraints within the training environment. So that's what I like to think about too, is like, how am I, through manipulating the task constraints, how am I interacting with their movement system? What adaptations am I creating? How is that changing how they connect with the information in the environment? So when one of the things that, at least in my experience, playing around with and using weighted bats, especially the end loaded bats, I noticed that I was better able to control my barrel into the zone. And I think, you know, from a strength standpoint, my wrists were stronger. I was better able to handle the inertia of the bat. But also from a proprioceptive standpoint, I had a little bit more perception of the bat in space. And this goes back to what we had talked about, I believe, in a previous podcast about, like, if we're using weighted bats and we're switching weighted bats, like, we should always move our bat around to help us recalibrate to how it's moving. So one of the things that I think is beneficial with like using an end loaded bat, if somebody is continually missing underneath the ball and maybe they have too much of an attack angle or too much of a vertical bat angle at contact. See, the thing though with that is it that they have too much or that their movement system perception is off and that's why they're missing it? So when we go back to talking about you know, swinging over or underneath the ball, mm-hmm. and when I was talking about I believe the me hitting off of a high velo machine and needing to swing way over the ball to recalibrate myself to where the ball was in relation to myself, I wonder if my vertical bat angle changed when I was hitting in that scenario, or if it stayed the same and my body just recalibrated and maybe my spine angle was the thing that changed. Mm-hmm. So those are things that I think would be interesting to look at with blast metrics. And then, because sometimes I think with technology, we often impose our theories into them and how we utilize them versus looking at, okay, what's actually occurring and what can that tell us about how they're moving, and utilizing the data to help us understand how they are moving. Because I even think that's how they designed BLAST and got the metrics itself, was actually recording the data from the swing and then figuring out, oh, hey, this is what this data point is and this is how it's moving. And so I think that's a more appropriate way to utilize technology versus trying to fit a technical model into technology.
That definitely, I think I see kind of like the angle that you're taking, but I think it's just more about like allowing the feedback that the tech, in this case BLAST, mm-hmm. is giving about a player,
mm-hmm.
and then like having that affect like how we're trying to get a certain change based on the information we're getting back.
Mm-hmm.
And then so that goes to like the environment that we put them in, right?
Well, I mean, it'll definitely influence it. And that's why with technology, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, you always question is like, okay, we have exit velos off of front toss. Okay, what does that mean? Like, how translatable is it? It's maybe similar to being like, oh, hey, cool, you can squat or deadlift or bench, you know, 300 or plus pounds in the weight room. Awesome. You know you have that raw capability. But the question is can you translate that to, you know, on the field? And so to me, I would want to look or get that sort of data more off of like BP or live pitching. That to me would be a better representation of data points. And so I think it also depends, because we know that the constraints, you know, being the task constraint and the environmental constraints, along with the individual's constraints, shape their movement. And so as we change the task or the training environment, that will affect their movement pattern and behavior. So one of the things that I posted recently was talking about representative learning design. And in that, you're looking at how well does the movement that you're doing in practice match to the what you see and observe in a game.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be the action fidelity. And so those types of things that we want to consider when we're looking at even the metrics themselves, like if they're not moving the way they would in a game, those metrics may not be useful. So I think that's why our eyes as a coach have to be coupled with what we're seeing with the metrics.
Right. And I want to clarify, I'm assuming that like the metrics that he's basing like these groups are mm-hmm. off of representative swings, I guess.
Sure.
So it's not like, you know, he's letting like the swings from these like drill work stuff to like, you know, get a desired change for whatever they're trying to accomplish. I don't think those are the swings that are, you know, that he's grouping these hitters off of.
Oh, for sure. And I think though, too, I think this is great, by the way. I just, one of the things that I fear or am try to be cognizant of when it comes to technology is, let's say somebody's numbers are bad, quote unquote, but what if it's actually what makes them good? So if they're being successful, what the technology does is it allows us to record what they're doing to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they start to deviate away from that and they're not having success, and you go put the technology on them, in this case, blast sensor, and now they've deviated from what they had originally, then it's like, okay, now we need to work back towards that and then utilize those types of drills that you had talked about. So I think it's not, I think coaches, and I've seen this happen based upon other people's data or an average aggregate of data of what elites do.
Mm-hmm.
They think that that applies to every individual. And I think we have to look at first, how is the individual moving and are they being successful with their current movement solutions? Then we need to document that with technology so that we can see any changes and then we can know whether or not those changes are good or bad based upon their performance. So I think as often as possible, we want to use the performance as a guide for intervention, so to speak.
I think I agree. Like, you don't want to try to change something that could be part of the reason why they're succeeding. 100% agree. That being said, I think there's still certain things that we can program out for players
mm-hmm.
that, you know, is pretty much like no matter what, like if you improve on that, it's not, you're not going to get worse. If that
makes for sure.
Like, there's more, like as far as like adjusting a player's like average attack angle, mm-hmm. there's probably a little more like leeway with like, okay, do we know like for sure like if this is going to be like if this is going to hurt them or not? Like, we have some pretty good ideas, and if, like I said, the like you said, if the data is supporting that, like on swings that he has, you know, an average attack angle of zero, he's, you know, hitting not, you know, very good. Mm-hmm. Then it's something where we can say, okay, well, we probably do need to prescribe a change for his attack angle. But that being said, there are things that, like, we know that by improving on, you know, the hitter's only going to get better, like swing speed, for example. So doing some sort of like programming in that department, like if we're measuring blasts and we know that a player's swing speed is like 20-25% below his peers,
mm-hmm.
then we know that, you know, we can probably program a weighted bat program
mm-hmm.
to try to increase that. So
For sure.
It's like, I understand what you're saying about like, let's, you know, and that's like for anything, like, let's just not blindly like apply the data without like having some sort of like logical process about what we're going to change. Like, is the desired change that we're going to ask the player to do, like, do we have a very strong belief that by changing this, it's actually going to improve their outcomes,
mm-hmm.
you know? And instead of, like you said, like just gearing changes to fit a, you know,
an what the aggregate. Metrics, yeah, right. What the metrics say in a broad sense. I mean, I think that's, well, I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask was, what are these ranges that are what we're kind of looking for or shooting for? Like, if we're talking about attack angle, like, what are the ideal attack angles to be working within?
Yeah, I think that Jason Ochard did a blog a long time ago about, like, what a good range of attack angles look like. And I think he kind of had two different buckets depending on what a player's, like, max exit velocity was. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, like, 5 to 15 range for players that like have a max exit velocity below 105. So it's kind of a more flat attack angle
mm-hmm.
to try to match the plane. So you're kind of prioritizing contact more.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas players that kind of have more power, give them maybe a little more leeway as far as like I think it was like 10 to 20 range. So your average somewhere around 15. So maybe a little less priority on making contact, but you're trying to optimize the batted ball when you strike it. So from a tag angle standpoint, again, context is important about the type of player. Swing speed, at the elite level player, at the elite player level, I think you're looking at, you know, swing speeds above like 80 to 85 are really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you what the average is because I think a lot of times, like, you have to slow down swing speeds for like different adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still, you know, barrel ball while like slowing yourself down. But I know that like anything above 85 as far as swing speed is pretty elite.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I found interesting looking at blast metrics versus like Zep, where I first started using a bat sensor. Zep was able to, like, I think my best on that was like 90 something. And then using blast, it's like averaging 60, and then mm-hmm. every now and then I get up above 70. And it makes me wonder, like, okay, what are the differences? I don't think it matters as long as they're consistent. And that's why when I've seen blast, categories of pro versus college versus high school, you know, it's close to 70-ish, maybe a little bit less. But one of the things that me and one of our video data guy at Missouri State we're talking about today was, why is it that time to contact is slightly negatively correlated to bat speed? And one of the things that I was kind of theorizing was that if your essentially if it takes you longer to get up to peak speed. So if you're catching the ball out front, your bat is going to have fully accelerated. If you catch the ball deeper in the zone, your bat hasn't fully accelerated yet, so your bat speed will be a little bit lower. And if you catch the ball deeper in your swing, that means that the amount of time that it took from the start of your swing to when you made contact is shorter than if you catch the ball out front, where you're going to have higher bat speed. So I think, at least to me, that is a logical reason for why you may see an inverse correlation with time to contact versus bat speed.
Yeah. Depth of contact obviously plays like a huge factor in that. And you hit the nail on the head as far as like, you know, that particular relationship. And it's funny because I've, like, specifically talking about blast, I've had conversation with people and, you know, they're like, well, I've seen, like, you know, a correlation analysis of, you know, whatever metrics. And
mm-hmm.
in the grand scheme of things, not many of them are, like, highly correlated with, like, batted ball outcomes or whatever, or successful batted ball outcomes. But it's kind of, you're using them not so much for, like, go ahead, save me a little bit because I'm trying to collect my thoughts.
Well, I think what you bring up is a very interesting point without realizing it. It's like, okay, so then why are we using this? At least, and I think there is a very valid case for using blast, but I think this is where, again, people misunderstand the purpose of technology. Like, they look at it for, well, why can't I just improve one metric? Like, if I focus on improving improving bat speed, then that'll lead to better hitting performance. Or if I focus on improving attack angle or time to contact or whatever these metrics that you want to talk about, connection score, etc., if they're not highly correlated, then what are we doing? Like, why are we trying to chase these metrics? And that's where I go back to what I was talking about before of, like, we just want to understand when they're going well, what are those metrics? Because if we go back to the motor learning stuff, it's really more about how well attuned is the hitter or the athlete to the specifying information? Because that will, I mean, hitting's all about coordination. It's not about what your bat speed is. It's not about what your attack angle is. It's about how you coordinated to hit that ball, which is going to be predicated on how your body connected with the information and interacted with the constraints within the environment. So to me, the technology just helps us explain the process and helps us try to help the athlete get back to what is good. But I think more importantly, though, it's going to be about how the athlete connects with the information. And as a coach, I'm trying to help guide them towards that.
Right. No, I think that what I was trying to say earlier is that the particular metrics aren't very predictive of success, mm-hmm. but we can use the metrics within the context of the player in order to, like you said, get them closer to where they need to be when things are going right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to lead to success. So, you know, everybody's swing is different. And I like what you said about, you know, understanding what's happening when things go right. That's why I like looking at these metrics when paired with batted ball information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So looking them.
So we can also then plug blast vision.
Well, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how accurate like
the exit reading. Velocity is it from my experience of even having like a pocket radar when they're hitting off of it. It was within 1 to 2 miles an hour. And then in talking with Blast Motion themselves, they've built it to be very close to what HitTrax is going to be. So if you're going to, you know, question its reliability, then you have to question all, models of projecting.
Fair enough. I guess what I should have clarified was that it also, like, when I say, like, let's look at things when they're going right, mm-hmm. like bat balls that are hit harder than 90,
mm-hmm.
we need to do that in environments that are representative of the game.
Oh, for
so
sure.
So I'm not really as concerned as much about, you know, what they're doing well when they're facing like flips. Like I want to see what this guy's profile looks like in game when he's hitting the ball well, if that mm-hmm. sort of makes sense.
Yeah, and I think this is, to go back to fall ball. Fall ball, I think, is probably one of the best times that you can do that, because you're going to scrimmage, and then you can put these sensors on the bats and utilize them in the scrimmage, which you might not be able to do during the season. And so that gives you some actual live game data that you can actually utilize and reference. So, I mean, that's how I would utilize Blast. Like I think it would be very important to try to capture that data in the fall, because you might not be able to or be allowed to capture that data in the spring until they create bats that you can just put the sensor right in the knob, mm-hmm. versus having to put the thing over the top of it. But
those are coming, by the way.
Yeah, I'm super excited for those. I was trying to think. There was something else that was related to utilizing the sensors, but kind of forgot it.
It's all right. I just to kind of, I guess, put a bow on uh-huh. on this. Again, I'm kind of like going back and clarifying like other things that I said, because
sure.
I don't want
for sure
people like misunderstand. Driveline did kind of a study. When pairing like blast metrics and batted balls, and I think they used HitTrax for their
mm-hmm.
Way of measuring, and I think the most correlated with like successful batted balls was bat speed and other like speed related metrics, whereas like, you know, attack angle, plane scores, like all those like related stuff was like somewhat low.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I think it's how we apply the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we can still use these things when evaluating hitters and kind of like what they are currently good at, maybe what they're currently bad at, and how we can kind of, like you said, use our best like guesstimations as far as in what areas they need to improve, and hopefully we're picking the right areas that, you know, isn't part of what's making them successful.
Well, the other thing too that I think I really like Blast for is, again, back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, was workload management. Like now I can actually count how many swings are taken. We can account for potentially the amount of force that is generated on that swing. And that at least gives me some idea of like how much work have they done today. And then on top of that, though, I think this goes back to show that like the metrics aren't everything in regards to if you just improve XYZ metric, you're automatically going to be good. I think that's, you know, how we try to justify ourselves in a training environment where we can't get outside and be in a game. But again, if we collect game data, then we can use that to assess how representative the practice design is, because if it's deviating too far away from what our in-game data looks like, maybe our practice design is not similar enough, does not have high enough representation. Because again, at the end of the day, it's all about transfer. So we want to, if we can collect, the more accurate data we can collect, or more game-like data we can collect, that can then better inform our practice design, because then it gives us something to try to shoot for in regards to that. I mean, the other thing too would be very interesting to figure out how to denote in the swing data, you know, off-speed pitch versus fastball, because that would be very good to collect and look at and then compare back to practice environments. Because let's say, for example, that we find out a majority of their off-speed swings have a lower bat speed, but in practice they all look like fastball speed. Well, it's like that might not be representative enough. Like, not that they shouldn't ever time up a ball and square it with their best metrics, but if most of the time they're going to be caught a little suboptimal, then maybe the training environment also needs to be more challenging and reflect that.
I think that's brilliant, honestly. And it's not something that I've really thought about as far as like how to apply Blast.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right. I mean, I think that by looking at how different players' metrics are from in-game to practice, I think that does tell a really powerful story about how good of training environments we're producing. So yeah, I think that's really smart and probably something that not a lot of people are currently doing too.
But the one thing that I want to, you know, put a caveat on, if the person is not being successful in the game environment, then you can't really utilize that data, you know, so then you can start to be like, well, maybe if we tweak some of these things, these metrics, if they fall outside of what we understand to be helping or contributing to success, then you can start to utilize it that way. But more often than not, I want to keep coming back to this, the way that I view it is maybe they're just not connecting with the information well enough. They're just not well enough attuned to that information. So that would be the first place that I would go to, is back to that, looking at the constraints that are influencing the hitter. And by constraints, I mean, what's their mental state? Because their mental state is going to affect their movement solution. So not necessarily in terms of, you know, like traditionally how it's often talked about with constraints, but like what are those things that are influencing their movement behavior, and making sure that all of those things are, they're not causing them to freeze their degrees of freedom in a way that hurts their ability to coordinate successfully. So I'd want to check those things first before I start chasing things that we had talked about before that may not have as high of a correlation to in-game performance. I would chase more of the like, hey, what's their process like? And then tying that with maybe trying to improve a metric that we see as being off.
I think that, and you mentioned that you would want to look at, is the player being successful in the game before looking, you know, before judging the success of of a practice environment or training environment.
Before judging the metrics that we are collecting or the data that we're collecting. We want to look at the performance and then judge the metrics that we're collecting.
But I think you can also kind of look at in-game failures too and match that up to, you know, training environments as well. Because then you look at, okay, so in the game, he's doing X, and he's also doing that in training. So then we know, like, that has, like, some carryover as far as, like, okay, well, maybe we need to improve this. Or if we see a differentiation of, you know, he's not doing this in the game and he's failing, but he's doing something different with that particular area of his swing, and he's relatively having more success in drill work, then we kind of know, I guess, that he's not carrying over that particular element
from
from training to the game.
Yep. And so then we want to, so this is where it's a good segue back to representative learning design, because that's where this kind of comes in, is like, we want to be thinking about what are the sources of information that the athlete can be attuning to? Like, what are the specifying pieces of information that they can be connecting with that's going to help them be successful? And the question is in our practice design, are those information sources present? And this goes back to the Bregman video of him talking about why he doesn't use the T. Although he doesn't express it, and maybe he doesn't even realize it, but it comes back to the sources of specifying information are not present when you're hitting off of a T, and they may be inappropriate hitting off of underhand flips. And he gave a good example or reason why he would use underhand flips, although I don't think that it may not provide enough specifying information, but at least there's an understanding that, oh, the how the ball moves does provide some information. And so underhand flips has some similarity, provides you know, one element of degrees, or you know, one degree of similarity of information that would possibly be present in a game. And so we want to think about that when we are designing our practices. What are the sources of information that an athlete needs to be able to make a good movement solution? And are we providing those in the practice? And I don't think we don't necessarily need to, or is it always possible to get all of those sources into a practice environment? But we want to think about how many are present in our practice environment.
Right. I think that's kind of the key, and I think probably what's most applicable to coaches. You know, like you said, do underhand flips have an element of like representation that T work doesn't? Yes. But could it also potentially have like a negative, or like could it have an element that doesn't exist that you're having to like account for? So for like my
that's a really good point, because you can attune to the wrong variables.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be highly sensitive and trying to utilize the wrong information for your movement solution. And then that makes it much harder for you to be successful when it comes game time. Hence, you may not have very good transfer of training.
Right.
Like that would be an example of bad.
So like for the underhand flips, for example, like an element that would exist there that wouldn't is just like the angle which the ball is coming towards you.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone flips it underhand, you could have, you know, scenarios where the ball is actually like rising towards you still.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hitting it. So you're not having to like to hit the ball flush. It's a lot different as far as like how you have to approach the ball. Granted, it's easier to kind of make contact with it because the ball is moving at a much lower speed. So that kind of gets overlooked as far as like having to become attuned for that like positive approach angle of the ball when in the game the ball leaving the pitcher's hand is coming down at you at a -7 degree mm-hmm. angle. So I think kind of just to sum up what you're saying, like the key for coaches that they can take away is how can we make representative environments that is at least somewhat easy to replicate and like is easy to do like logistically.
Yeah, I mean some of that is true, but we also really like I want to keep going on this information train because it's really, really important, I think. We want to, and that's why I pose the question of like, we want to begin to investigate the problem that the athlete is trying to solve. And there's the Bernstein quote of what no natural phenomenon can be understood without first examining the environment in which it emerged from. And so I would challenge coaches to have part of their analysis be of the game of like, what are the information sources that the athlete is interacting with and connecting to? And then from there, we can then prioritize those and try to figure out ways to get them into practice. I don't want to kind of give all of the ones because I think there's some value in people trying to learn it for themselves. But this is where I think, like, front toss, yes, if you can create the ball flight angle, but we know that because of how fast the game moves or, you know, with velocity and balls that move late and all that sort of stuff, guys who are better at picking up the information pre-pitch that aids in ball flight, they can make better predictions or better pick up the specifying information, the ball flight information, much better if they can couple that with the pre-pitch information. So that's where something like front toss, even if you were to get the flight, the ball flight angle correct, is less representative than something that provides pre-pitch information, specifying information that the athlete can connect with. And so that would be another reason why, at least for me, I don't like utilizing pitching machines too much because it also lacks a lot of pre-pitch information. And the pre-pitch information is vastly different than what it would be off of a live arm.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%. Just as far as like the difference between a flip and, you know, a pitcher going through their windup, trying to track the arm, pick up the arm,
mm-hmm.
the ball leaving the arm. I mean, that's just...
And that, I think, plays a lot into timing. Like, and I don't think coaches appreciate what timing is connected to. And each hitter will have to connect to different specifying information from a pitcher, and it will change from pitcher to pitcher as well. And hitters need to learn their process for calibrating their timing, as well as attuning to the specifying information from the pitcher.
Yeah. So it's funny you say that, because one of the things that I would do when I was working with guys is I would basically change my tempo and like speed and rhythm mm-hmm. when I was throwing BP. So I'm trying to like, I'm on a little platform, so I'm trying to like replicate the angle, and I would just mix up between being in the stretch, doing a full windup, and just kind of like changing the speeds. Just because, like you said, like each pitcher is a little bit different. So as far as like, you know, getting accustomed to, you know, practicing that timing element, I think is something that helped them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's an easy way to at least have like that kind of element displayed in, you know, what you're doing in practice. Again, I know we talked about batting practice a lot last week, so I don't want to get too much into it. But the one thing that I've seen people like defend, I guess, these types of ways to swing
mm-hmm.
that might not be super representative is that it's easier, it's like less stress on the hitter so that they can maybe make a change easier. So for example, like you can work on maybe something, a mechanical issue, maybe easier with the ball not moving.
Yeah, but okay, it goes back to though when we're talking about attractor wells in one of the previous ones, it's like, okay, if you're inputting the same stimulus over and over again trying to get a change, maybe you're just digging the attractor well deeper and creating even more of a stabilized pattern. And the athlete needs to be able to connect to the information. And if you don't have the information present, they're not going to be able to know how to deploy or coordinate their system when that information is present. So they're going to me, you're making the process longer than it needs to be, because they're going to need time to adjust and get adjusted to that information again. So I don't know. That's where for me it just I think when you look at the principles of, you know, attractor states, you need to have there's more effective ways of changing attractor states.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that one of the reasons like people emphasize like, well, it's easier or it's better to make a change off of, you know, a tee. Well, maybe it is. And maybe like hitters can feel that and they can kind of like succeed quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like if it doesn't transfer to the actual like game, then, you know, it's all for naught anyway.
Well, and that's the other thing of like, the other reason why I think coaches like to do that is because they can get the athlete to perfect it, and they hang their hat on things looking clean and sharp and disciplined. And sometimes those things are good to have things be disciplined, but it's more of a question of, well, does it lead to improved performance? Like, yeah, you can have troops that are really well drilled and really can execute it well, but when they get into the chaos of battle, they're completely lost because the environment that they've trained in had no variability within it that they had to learn how to connect with the information and then adjust their response. And the same thing is true of when it comes to sport performance. And that's also very true of you know, stuff done in the weight room. I think that's more applicable in the weight room because of injury prevention and whatnot. But if you want to be a stickler for technique, that's probably where you want to live, because that's very much more acceptable there. But if we're getting out into having to respond to a changing dynamic environment, you're going to have to be okay with it being messy.
Yeah, I think that's just, you know, a lesson we all kind of have to learn, is that, you know, if we want some real actual positive change, things are going to have to be messy, you know, and it feels better to do something where it's safe, like a tea or a tea work or whatever, to, you know, make a change. But like you said, I think that
it's the environmental constraint of sociocultural, the people not wanting to be judged, because if your stuff looks messy, then you feel like that is reflected on your coaching ability. And I think that's why it's a big risk for coaches, and why it's much easier, why coaches want to or drawn to doing that. But if you want to be successful, so oftentimes people who are successful are willing to go against the grain and go against what other people think of them. And in this case, like, that would be, you know, why I would advocate for this approach that's going to look much more messier. You're not going to have as much clean execution as you're used to. And guys are going to be more frustrated. But I think that's where, as a coach, it's our job to help players understand the process. But we also may need to, at times, scale back the information or the things that are present within the task, and maybe simplify it so that they can have some level of success, so that we can challenge them again. So that would be my pitch for why I would advocate for more variability, more challenge within practice.
Awesome. Well, I think that might be a good place to stop, and maybe next time we could kind of talk about what it looks like to scale back the challenge, I guess, to, you know, make it to where, you know, it's obviously challenging, but not to where, you know, they're failing so mm-hmm. much that they're not connecting to the information or the environment. So I think, that's probably where, you know, the art of coaching is found, is being able to kind of know and feel out, like, what that looks like. So mm-hmm. is there any last things that you'd like to add?
I had some stuff, but then I forgot it.
Well,
which I guess now has happened a couple times.
I'm sure that you'll remember it by the next time that we get together.
Well, and I think it more had to do with kind of what you were pitching about, what we're going to talk next time about. I think it's going to be like, how do we understand this from ecological dynamics perspective? Of what do we do when athletes are struggling, and how do we go about the process of helping them get back on track and working through that to then find success? So that's what we're hoping to cover next time.
Yeah, I think that would be great, because that's something that I think all coaches, you know, need help with or could get better at. So mm-hmm. next time we'll come together and hopefully figure out what to do when players aren't succeeding and what we can do to help them get there.
Sounds good. We'll talk to you guys next time.